us.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Hackers aren't all bad, despite what you've heard about them. In fact, the original definition of the word hacker is someone who makes innovative customizations or combinations of retail, electronic, and computer equipment, or one who, in the programming culture, combines excellence, playfulness, cleverness, and exploration in the design of their code. It was only later that some turned to the dark side to exploit weaknesses in computer code and computer networks in an effort to wreak havoc. So let's concentrate on that subset of good guys. Many of them regularly meet in button-down Charlotte. Actually, it's in cyberspace at a digital meetup site called Charlotte Hackerspace, which also has a bricks-and-mortar location, I'm told, which, in their words, geeks can feel free to tinker and evolve technology. On occasion, these computer gurus like to lend a hand to us lesser mortals who sometimes struggle when interfacing with the digital world. They believe that helping others become comfortable on computers, on the internet, and within the confines of their own software can improve the lives of the city's residents. And it's not only happening at Charlotte Hackerspace, it's happening at Queens University of Charlotte. It's happening with the County of Mecklenburg. So we'll let them explain all of this. We're joined this hour by Dr. Eric Friedman, Dean of the Knight School of Communication at Queens University of Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Brian Cox is director of Mecklenburg County's Business Support Services Agency, which includes internal support for the county, as well as including information technology, public information, and web services, and GIS, or Geographic Information Systems.
Thanks, Mike.
To the public at large, welcome back to the program. There's a GIS confab going on right outside this door. Is that you?
That is us. GIS Day is going on at Spirit Square right now, and if you're listening and you want to learn more about it, come on down.
Okay, we'll talk some more about that as we go through the program. And Red Davies is the founder of Hackerspace Charlotte and also is an open source developer who speaks and teaches at programming workshops around the world. Welcome to the program.
Good to see you. Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning. If the word hacker started with this positive definition that I alluded to a moment ago, how did we come to associate it with people involved in trying to do mischievous things that really are not only annoying but destructive? How did that happen?
I think it's because some of the skills required in order to do that and wreak havoc actually requires some of the skills that, you know, regular good hackers have. The way that I like to draw the distinction between a hacker and someone who breaks into systems and steals stuff is we use the term for hacker, who uses the technology appropriately, and we use the term criminal for people who don't. Very clear cut.
Very good for you. I don't want to spend a lot of time on that aspect of this, but I do want to get, I just want to get into the mind of somebody who sits down, who has the skills to sit down and decide, I'm going to write a little piece of code here that's either going to wipe the hard drive of some innocent user who clicks on this email message, or install a piece of malware that's going to really hurt his or her ability to use the computer, or sit down and write a piece of code that's going to just obliterate a network. Why would you do that?
Well, the motivation for such things has evolved over time. If you go right the way back towards the beginning of this kind of behavior, it was about bragging rights, and it was about showing your peers that you were able to write software that did stuff that other computer technologists would think would be impossible. If you go back when we had computers that were not networked, the idea of a virus spreading from computer to computer when there's no mechanism other than sharing, for example, floppy drives, that was quite a technological achievement. And malice wasn't necessarily motivation. It was, bring up a funny thing and say, yep, I did that kind of thing. Of course, now in the modern day, the number of people with those skills has increased, and that means you now have criminals that have those skills, and the motivation for things like that now is more, frankly, money.
Quite honestly, I can understand that, because it's a way to steal from people.
Absolutely.
If you can break into a bank network or steal somebody's passwords to get into their own banking system, that's one thing. But the other, some of these viruses don't do anything but cause problems. So if there's no monetary gain for the person making these things, why do it?
There is always monetary gain nowadays. You just don't necessarily see it.
Those people that do those things are people who really do know what they're doing on a computer and with code. There are those of us who may not know a lot about computers and can barely turn one on. Queen's University of Charlotte has started something called Digital Charlotte to promote digital and media literacy, and there are two different things there. Why have you decided to do this, and what exactly do you mean by digital literacy?
Sure. By digital media literacy, we're talking about giving people the tools to work with, access, create, and ultimately become civically engaged in a networked environment. It's an environment that we're all functioning in. And we're trying to equip people to be much more systems literate. In other words, we all have electronic devices that we use. We all operate in pre-constituted, private, or commercial online spaces like Facebook. But the more we use these tools, the less we are – and the more naturalized these tools become, the less engaged we are in terms of what we call systems literacy, understanding how they operate.
Why do we have to understand? If you turn your computer on and you get on Facebook and you do what you need to have done – why do you need to understand how it works?
It's attached to the premises of sort of digital media literacy. For instance, when you work with a search engine, when you type something into Google or whichever engine you choose to use, do you have the facility, the faculties to know which of these results is privileged? Is there results bias? We talk about search engine optimization. Can you trust what you get?
That's literacy. That's digital literacy.
That's the literacy piece. So if you know how these architectures operate, you may know how to work with the engine to force it to give you the results that you're
looking for. Because when you work with Google, for instance, the search results that come to the top are paid for.
Correct. Right.
So there may be some bias there.
Exactly. So part of the literacy piece is helping people. It's not necessarily hacking into Google, but it's at least understanding the architecture, the backbone. Likewise, when you work with Facebook, what does Facebook allow you to do or not do? What is being indicated in your privacy settings that you may or may not know about? How can you use it in an informed way, in an ethical way, helping people
be a bit more conscious?
Let me
cut to the chase on all this safety and privacy concerns. Can you trust anything you put into a computer or into a computer that is networked or into a search engine or into Facebook? Can you trust any of it to stay private today?
I think you have to enter these spaces knowing that anything that you input is going to be public or going to be accessible.
In fact, isn't everything public? Isn't the NSA looking at everything?
Certainly.
Everything.
Certainly.
And should I care? Unless I'm planning to put a bomb someplace, should I care? Yes. Why
yes,
should I
you
care?
Absolutely should care. Because you are an individual and you are an individual being. You are not property of the state.
Okay.
So if that makes sense, it's yes. Like
so given the – because as I was asking Dr. Friedman, is anything you put into Facebook, anything you put into a search engine private, and you're shaking your head no – given that, should we be on computers? Should we be using these devices?
What we should be doing is being very conscious of what we provide and be aware that anything that you put in, anything you put into a computer anywhere could be stolen, could be published. I mean, it could be taken by you know, your friends and published out without your consent.
Are all these cloud services, SkyDrive, iCloud, Dropbox, Box, are all these cloud storage services, are any of them safe? Are any of them impenetrable? Is your data protected?
It is protected to a certain point, but nothing is impenetrable. There is no such thing as 100% security because it's an arms race. For every technique that somebody develops to attack, we develop a defense. For every defense we develop, somebody else develops an attack.
Queen's University has started something called Digital Charlotte to mm-hmm. promote all of this, the digital and media literacy. You're trying to determine where we are in terms of our need for understanding all this. So do you know where we are on a sliding scale from knowing nothing to Uber programmer? Where are we?
Sure. And part of our sort of founding principle, the Knight School is endowed by the Knight Foundation, and our charge is to work inside a local media ecosystem, in this case Charlotte, to assess baseline digital media literacy. So we did a survey back in October 2012 to see where are we on the scale? Can we develop an index that shows to what extent do people have those critical analytical tools? To what extent do they even have access? So before we start sort of scaring people off the computer, can we say, well, where are people in terms of this, their access to technology? And what we found is there are some pockets of activity. There are some neighborhoods in the greater Charlotte area where between 30 and 40% of homes don't have, are not wired for an internet access. So we have a huge percentage of the population greater than the norm, which is, tends to hover around 17 to 20%, who are not even on the internet, who don't even have access, who don't have access to the basic tools to become plugged in, to become part of the networked community in Charlotte. So,
and are you trying to change that, or are you just keeping track of it?
We're trying to change that. So we cannot solve the access piece. We can't solve the infrastructure piece, but we've been partnering with organizations like Connect to Compete, with Time Warner and Connect a Million Minds to get those homes wired. And then our project through Digital Charlotte on digitalcharlotte.org is to say, now that you're online, what are you going to do there? What choices are you going to make? Can we also create what we call a connected learning laboratory to link together all of these partner agencies who are doing really solid work in this digital and media literacy continuum, like the county, like the libraries, like Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools?
That was my next question. Brian Cox is here from Mecklenburg County, and I'm just curious as to why the county is interested in any of this and why the county has and we're going to talk some more about what the county is doing in terms of putting its records online for the public to have access to. Why are you interested in all of this?
Well, as Dr. Friedman mentioned tools a couple of times, and that alludes to a process. Red talked about the what you can do with the information. We are really the source. We're the raw materials, if you look at that process. We have a lot of data that is oriented to property, land, those type of records. So I guess maybe we're providing some of those materials for those tools to be used, for that expertise to be applied to.
Many people may not know about this, but all of those records that used to be available only by going down to the courthouse and looking through files and microfiche, it's all up there on the Mecklenburg County City of Charlotte website, and you're making much, if not all, of that information publicly available. Are people availing themselves of that opportunity?
It is a lot of the land record information is heavily used. Now, I want to make one point is, because we were talking about security earlier,
right.
We also are stewards of a lot of information that is personal and private, and that information is not available, and we spend as much time, again, as Red said, trying to come up with ways to ensure that information is protected while we're also trying to make the information that can serve the greater good available.
Of course, you could always have gone down. In the 1950s, if you were curious about what your neighbor paid for their house, you could go to the courthouse and look it up. Now, with a couple of keystrokes, bang, there it is right in front of you. Has that changed anything? Has it made us less, more open to invasion of privacy?
Well, it certainly has raised awareness to safety. And again, using the tool metaphor, it's like any tool. If you were giving someone without any training, this ties into the digital literacy, digital learning, gave them a power tool without any instruction and said, and asked, is that safe? The answer would probably be no. If you teach them how to use the tool, how to take the appropriate care in using it, it is safe and it can be very productive and it can end up with an end product that you're gonna want to use. So it really is. It's just a digital version of things that we've been doing forever.
Brian Cox is the Director of Business Support Services for Mecklenburg County. We're also here with Dr. Eric Friedman, Dean of the Knight School of Communications at Queen's University of Charlotte, and Red Davies, the founder of Hackerspace Charlotte. We're going to talk about all of these things. We're going to hopscotch all over the computer universe here today. So stay with us. We're taking a break. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Northeastern University Charlotte, a strong tie to the Charlotte community and the world beyond with 3,000 corporate partners. Programs in energy systems, engineering and project management, education and more. Northeastern.edu/enroll. And Audi of Charlotte presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at Audi of Charlotte. CharlotteCharlotte.com. Well, forget Black Friday or Cyber Monday. For that matter, forget Thanksgiving, because the stores will be open on Thanksgiving Day. And the bargains, I'm told, have already begun. So we're going to take a look at holiday shopping trends online versus bricks and mortar shopping and something called holiday creep in the first part of the program tomorrow. And then a playwright who turned her experience of growing up in an ashram into a play. That's coming up tomorrow at 9.
On the next Day and Ream show, a public rift in the Cheney family highlights the ongoing debate and controversy over the rights of gays and lesbians to marry, evolving attitudes on same-sex marriage.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. We're talking about the world of computers and computer information and computer literacy, digital literacy. What does Queen's University hope to achieve by helping people become more digitally literate?
Right. We see it in essentially two phases, beyond the initial access piece that I talked about. The first phase is making sure that people have the tools that they need to function in their everyday lives. So we look at sort of resources like Goodwill of the Southern Piedmont to say, are there certain digital tools, digital assets that you need, skill sets that you need to find a new job, do you have the financial literacy? So our first step is, do you have the digital literacy required of you to be a sort of a functional sort of individual in your everyday life, to connect to county, to city services, to know how to get to your local library, those basic core services? And that's our first step. Do you have the things that you need to survive and thrive? Mm-hmm. The second step is, once you are a fully engaged digital citizen with all of the resources that you need, can you ultimately become civically engaged? And that's our greater goal through digital literacy, is to foster civic engagement.
Explain that piece of it. I was going to get to that later, but I don't really understand the benefit of that. So
sure.
Help me understand it.
It's beyond thinking about sort of networked information as simply pure data. Can we harness data? Can we harness information to become more informed and engaged communities, to think about harnessing data to improve the quality of life in our communities? This is partly, I think, why we call it the quality of life dashboard, and not simply a database. So one of the examples that I give is, we've been hosting a series of neighborhood workshops, reaching out to some of the more sort of marginalized neighborhoods in the Northwest and Northeast Charlotte area, to pull community members together, neighborhood organizations together, to say, can we help you build neighborhood communication strategies? Can we help you build what we're calling a neighborhood information toolkit? In other words, a lot of neighborhoods are having difficulty thinking about improving the quality of life just among sort of the individuals in a local community. Newsletters aren't working. Their community centers don't have the equipment that they need to connect to city or county services. So can we help them build successful digital strategies to really bind them together as a group?
How would you do that if they don't have in their community centers a computer that can connect on the internet to the county GIS system, mm-hmm. or whatever the system may be? How would you help them? Would you just give them a computer and an internet connection? What would you do?
Part of it is thinking about sustainability, because some of these communities, some of these neighborhood organizations, they may have a center where computers were dropped off, but they weren't given a whole lot of instruction on sort of, now that these things are here, what do you actually do with them?
Yeah.
So a lot of it is simply, being on the ground, going into neighborhoods to help them think about the resources that are at their disposal.
As we approach the Christmas shopping season, and I mentioned, I think I mentioned in the promo for tomorrow's show, we're going to be talking about Black Friday and Cyber Monday, which is the internet version of Black Friday, where people get online and they search for bargains. Doesn't everybody know how to do that in 2013? I mean, doesn't everybody know how to buy something from Amazon or get on a search engine? and look, search for best prices? And if you can do that, why can't you do what you're talking about?
Well, a lot of individuals don't – well, A, it's the access piece. You know, is everyone using their smartphone to its full capacity? And what we found in our survey is a lot of people who have smartphones aren't necessarily using them to connect to the internet. So I think firstly, you know,
is that because they can't afford the data plan, or is it because they don't know how to use the phone?
Some of it's a little bit of both. Some as I've said, some households simply don't have. It's an economic choice. You know, what am I going to spend money on? Is it putting food on the table, or is it sort of wireless internet access at home? Unfortunately, that also impacts, you know, families, because we have school kids who are in bring your own technology environments, who go home and then don't have that the same type of access that they need in their homes to really be sort of informed students.
So the Digital Charlotte website, is that you?
Correct.
Okay. Says that Digital Charlotte transforms the greater Charlotte area into a connected learning laboratory. It's described as a collection of groups in a virtual gathering place. Put that in simpler terms, because if you're not computer literate, you may not understand even what I just said.
Sure.
Nor see the need for it.
Correct. We do, through Digital Charlotte, we do essentially two things. We build essential tools, you know. So if you're looking to learn about why might I use a social network, how do I set my privacy settings, how do I work with iMovie, how do I know? So what we have in part is a series of tools. So our first year collaboration has been primarily with the libraries. If we look at Charlotte-Mecklenburg libraries, there are essentially 18 libraries across the greater Charlotte area, across Mecklenburg County. And we've been dialoguing with the librarians about their patrons, saying, okay, if we're talking about homes that are not wired and we think about the libraries as a resource, so I don't have internet access in my home, where do I go? I go to my library. Now that I'm at my library, what am I looking to do there, you know, once I get online? So we dialogue with the libraries to say, what are the central problems or concerns or questions or needs that your patrons have when they come to your computer center? And can we build tools that answer the questions that your patrons are bringing with them to your locations?
One thing that is abundantly clear about technology is that it's growing by leaps and bounds, and it is changing more rapidly than perhaps we can even keep up with it. I know that in broadcasting, it certainly has the equipment that we use now is nothing like it was 10 years ago, even 5 years ago in some cases. After 50 years of nothing ever changing, now it changes day by day almost. And the same thing is happening out there in the world, because smartphones, every iteration of a smartphone has more power, more stuff you can do with it. And the same is probably true with operating systems on computers. Is part of the challenge here, mm-hmm. getting people up to speed in a constantly changing world where what you tell them how to do today is going to be different tomorrow.
Oh, certainly. And this is why we're in a unique position working inside Charlotte, because unlike some of these sort of national sort of online resources, as a localized resource, we can be very quick and very responsive. A patron can tell us, this is my need, and we can immediately build a tutorial or answer a question that addresses that need, or more importantly, point them to the resource in this local media ecosystem, whether it be Goodwill or at their school or the Urban League. We can point them to any service provider who might provide some assistance to them.
How does this work? Are you looking for individual people to come to you? Are you looking for community leaders to come to you, or organizations to come to you for this information and this advice and counsel? How does it work?
We do both a top-down and a bottom-up approach. So we start by looking at the largest agencies, because part of our philosophy is training the trainers. We may not be able to reach every individual, but if we can reach the major agencies that are reaching those individuals, like the libraries, the schools, and Goodwill, we know by working with them, by becoming a central portal or conduit, anything that we push out will make it to their patrons. And the inverse is also true. We host workshops on the Queen's campus and in the field, one-on-one, deeper, more engaged workshops like our neighborhood workshops that are these intensive sessions where any individual, any Charlotte area resident can come in mm-hmm. to a scheduled workshop and say, I want to learn how to use Blogger. I want to learn how to use iMovie.
Is it
all for free? And our students become our sort of digital training workforce. Mm-hmm. They are our labor. They are, as students, always learning, always evolving. So anything new that we throw at them, any of these new requests, new devices, new pieces of software, they're fully equipped to learn and execute.
I notice you keep talking about iMovie, which is an Apple product, and most of the people in the world are on Microsoft mm-hmm. platforms. Most of them, not all, but most of them are. So are there comparable classes for whatever Microsoft can provide?
Oh, sure. And we try not to be so dictated, you know, determined or attached to one platform, especially since a lot of what we do is working with open source tools. You may have a huge percentage of your client base may not be, you know, have the resources to buy software. Mm-hmm. So is there open source? Is there freeware? Is there shareware that will also satisfy that need?
Now, today, the Queen's University of Charlotte and the Knight School of Communication, we're partnering with the City of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County on a hackathon for today to help people understand how to use all of this information and to encourage educational institutions to challenge students to build programs or apps around all this data that the city and the county have made available. But the hackathon, Brian, was postponed or canceled. What happened? Lack of interest? Lack of hackers?
Well, maybe a little both. We did have interest from four or five teams mm-hmm. of people that were going to look at the data sets we provided.
Because the challenge here was pretty tough.
Yeah, it was open. It was we were going to provide the data, leave it somewhat open for people to create, and I don't know. I can't get in the minds of the people who decided they couldn't pull it off by the deadline. But we're going to try it again. We think it's worth doing, and it's a good way to promote the concept. Even though this one was canceled, we're sitting here talking about it, so we're optimistic.
So the apps, the challenge was to build, to be able to take this open source data that you've made available, mm-hmm. this voluminous amount of information about city and county stuff, and the challenge was for people who were highly computer literate to build apps and other ways to mine this data quickly and efficiently.
The data is it was again wide open, so it was not formatted, organized. It wasn't just a bunch of reports. It was, I used the raw materials description earlier, throwing the clay out on the table and challenging people to mold whatever they think can be a meaningful product for an end user.
And some of this data, I'm told, was from a very large data set that came from a City of Charlotte project called the Quality of Life Study. And the city was hoping that hackers would take a look at that data and find a way to parse out the highlights. Were they actually – I don't know if you can speak for the city on this or not, but were they actually hoping for analysis that they had not already done? Is the county looking for that sort of thing, or are you looking – for a new way to look at this material so that even you learn something about it?
I think it's probably the latter, a new way of looking at things. The quality of life data is actually in a format that's fairly usable for people now, and we were talking about hackathon earlier. Maybe another term people are familiar with is mashup, where you take something and build upon it, and I think that's really more of, with the quality of life information, what could have been done.
I think part of the challenge here, too, is it's back to the literacy piece. It's, we can push out data, but if that data is not presented in a way that people actually want it, so they're not going to use it. So part of the challenge of the hackathon is to ask people, how would you like to see your data? How would you like it visualized? You know, what would be of greatest use to you in terms of a user interface?
And isn't that what people who develop apps for phones and for I guess the Windows 8 operating system and other people that use apps, isn't that what they're doing? They're trying to come up with a little teeny piece of software that manipulates information in a way that end users want it.
Absolutely. At least as far as the business side goes, the motivation for hackers at hackathons, though, tends to be slightly different. The motivation for myself and some of my fellow hackers for hackathons is really more of the challenge. With the modern languages that come out, it's possible to develop very complex web applications in something as little as 2 days. Perfect example of that, there were two developers that did almost a replica of the healthcare.gov site in 2 days using some rapid prototyping tools.
Yes, is that the Sherpa?
Yes.
Yes, it's wonderful. It works.
with those kinds of tools and those kinds of languages, which are now very common in our community, we could actually build stuff up with this.
This is not exactly on the topic, but given the fact that the healthcare.gov website is an unmitigated disaster of epic proportions, and these guys, three guys I think it was, mm-hmm. who are in their 20s, mm-hmm. were able to come up with a website in 2 days
yes.
that aggregates information and lets you can't buy the insurance, but you can go through and you can find out what it's going to cost and what your subsidies will be according to zip code. Why couldn't the government and why couldn't these massive companies that we undoubtedly paid millions of dollars to develop this website, why couldn't they do it?
The answer actually is very, very similar to the parallel you drew with your studio. These large companies are still using development models that are in some cases 10 years old. Whereas the modern developers, those who are on the leading edge, some of us are using frameworks which are 6 months old or a year old, which are designed for rapid development because success on the internet and success in business is all about time to market. And so the faster you can bring it to market, then the better off you're going to be. And that's why all these rapid tools exist.
Could Mecklenburg County have done the healthcare.gov website? I mean, you have a pretty good website that has all this information on it that's relatively easy to access. Could you have done it?
Well, I don't think we could have done it, but we would have approached it differently. I think part of the issue that they may have had is, and it's the old cliche, how do you eat an elephant? Well, we're going to try to eat it all in one bite. And what clever developers have done is, well, they looked at a portion of it.
Right.
And I think that approach is a large part of the problem there.
Now, getting back to talking about the hackathon that was to be today and all this information that you have out there on the county website for people to use, although you'd like to hackers to come in and develop apps to make it easier to use and to make it more pinpoint precise in terms of what you're going after. The county and the city spent a lot of money, I would think, collecting this data, and yet you're putting it out there free. Why?
Well, I would argue the people have already paid for it. It's already collected as part of the normal process of just running city and county government. Land records information is when addresses are assigned. I mean, that information goes somewhere. Mm-hmm. That's part of a process that's already in place. It's always been there before computers. You could go to a file room somewhere, find the big book, pull it off the shelf, blow the dust off of it, and go and find it. It's just now that we have the ability, and that was available to the public as well. You just had to go to the courthouse and get it. Now we're able to put it on the internet, so it's basically in your living room. You don't have to go down to the courthouse to get it.
And, Red, you've pointed out that it's not how much this information, this data is worth, or how much it costs to collect it. It's the value you get from it. Explain that.
Absolutely. Well, if you spend, say, $12 or $15 million collecting data, and then you let it rest in a database in a building, it's not really doing anyone any good. If you push it out to your community and you push it out to people who know how to manipulate this stuff, mm-hmm. then they can create tools and programs, and they can give you insights into the data that you may not have ever had budget for or anything like that. And what value, I mean, the value of the data is what is done with it.
Right.
It's not the actual data itself. So the more widely you distribute it, the more benefit you're going to get.
I asked Brian Cox why he thought people didn't sign up for this hackathon today, which was supposed to be today. And you run Hackerspace Charlotte. You deal with people who do this kind of thing. What was the fatal flaw in this? Why didn't people want to participate?
To be honest with you, we didn't hear about it until after the submission deadline.
Ah, timing.
And promotion.
Last night, I was at the general meeting, uh-huh. and I basically addressed the general meeting and showed them the data that was up there, and we had four teams volunteer right there and there. So we're here. You have really smart people in Charlotte. Engage us.
Okay, we're going to come back. We're going to find out exactly what this hackerspace place is and find out more about digital and media literacy as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Thank you.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Fisher & Phillips LLP, a national labor and employment law firm representing employers in North Carolina from the Charlotte and Columbia offices. Partner Mike Honeycutt and Fisher & Phillips on the web at laborlawyers.com. And Trader Joe's offering steamed lentils from Normandy, France. These small, fully cooked French lentils can be used in a side dish, soup, or in a cold salad. Store locations at traderjoes.com. A public rift in the Cheney family highlights the ongoing debate and controversy over the rights of gays and lesbians to marry. Diane and her guests talk about evolving American attitudes toward same-sex marriage, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. Now, if you'd like to join our conversation, eschew the telephone and get on the computer, because that's what we're talking about. WFAE.org/CharlotteTalks. It will get you to us in every way possible. We're coming right back.
At Snap Judgment, we tell stories about people who jump and wait for the universe to catch them.
Are we ready for this? No, but who is? Let's do it.
Snap Judgment, the smoking hot show from NPR. Storytelling with a beat. Saturdays at 8 p.m. or Fridays at 10 p.m. on WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about computer literacy and hacking and people who have no experience and people who have a ton of experience, and the fact that there's all this data out there from magnificent sources like the county that is just waiting to be manipulated by somebody, in a good way, by the way. We'll talk about all this with Dr. Eric Friedman, who is the dean of the Knight School of Communications at Queen's University of Charlotte. Brian Cox is the director of business support services. He deals with all this information that's out there on the web for the county, Mecklenburg County. And Red Davies is founder of a place called Hacker Space Charlotte, where really highly computer literate and fairly innovative, creative types hang around, sharing their ideas, collaborating, looking for something to do with all of their skills. Is that a relatively accurate description of Hackerspace?
That's fairly accurate. The assets of the Hackerspace are the people that are there. I wouldn't describe everyone there as being, you know, in that top tier. We're open to everyone. Mm-hmm. And we have a lot of people come in and want to learn.
As I read about this yesterday, I had never heard of this before. Mm-hmm. And I know that there are other Hackerspaces around the country. It's kind of a phenomenon. It sounds like a really loosey-goosey kind of place where you go and just hang around and maybe come up with an idea and try to pursue it with other people or learn from other people. It doesn't sound terribly structured.
And that's intentional. The problem with structure is that then you can't turn on a dime. You can't have someone walk into your building and say, hey, I'm really interested in this particular subject. Does anyone know about it? And suddenly 15 people say, hey, I hadn't thought of that. And then they all get together and do stuff. Mm-hmm. We're here to facilitate, you know, whatever it is that people want to do.
Now, it's both a bricks and mortar mm-hmm. entity, but it's also a website, I'm told, right?
Yes.
It's a not-for-profit aimed at like-minded hackers. And again, this is hacking in the good sense, the
yes.
good definition of the word. You say we teach, learn, and hack. So in the good sense of the word, what is that? What is hacking to you?
So hacking to me is basically applying anything. So if, for example, we do small fabrication, so people have built 3D printers. Last night we had a gentleman come in who had a successful Kickstarter campaign, and he brought in a 3D scanner. And so we spent the evening scanning people's faces and then trying to get them to print on 3D printers. And we've got like our own little – it's just whatever it is we want to do at the time. It's very unstructured, but we have done some structured programs. For example, when you were speaking before about wiring up the community – a couple of our members got together and set up a computer lab and ran a computer lab for homeless people in NODA to give that kind of access to people who wouldn't normally have it.
And did people use it?
Yes, people used it, which was very gratifying.
Mm-hmm.
Also in Haiti, we had a Laptops for Haiti project where we partnered with a local scrap merchant who gave us 3 or 4 pallets of broken laptops, and we just stripped them all down, reassembled them, and we sent somewhere in the region of 20 to 30 laptops out to schools in Haiti. So these are all personal projects of people at the hackerspace, but when one person gets a passion, and that passion is infectious, and we'll just do it.
Because that's what I was curious about, because it sounds so unstructured that if somebody comes up with a great idea, it kind of spreads like wildfire through the group, and they all get on board for the time that they're involved in that. But how do you keep them focused? Because I could come in the middle of this and have another great idea, and suddenly everybody floods over to my side of the room. How does that work?
It's all about enthusiasm. If you wish your project to succeed, you have to be enthusiastic. Enthusiasm is infectious.
Evidently, this idea of hackerspaces is infectious. I understand that you put a post – when you got the idea that you wanted to start one in Charlotte, you put a post up on meetup.com.
Yes.
For people who wanted to be – who were interested in this, to come to Panera Bread on Providence Road at such and such a day and such and such a time. And 60 people showed up. They had to rope off a section of the restaurant for you guys, and it's led to what this is today. How do you explain that kind of interest in this kind of activity?
To be completely honest with you, I didn't expect that kind of response. I thought Banking Town were going to have very strict developers, very button-tie, as you said, button-tie Charlotte. But when you actually crack the surface, we have some incredibly creative people around here, and it's all about getting those creative people together. And once you give them an opportunity and a place to do that and a place to mingle and bounce ideas off each other, it becomes a multiplier for technology in the community.
What kind of things have come out of either this hackerspace or others around the country that we may or may not have heard about?
Okay, so a couple of things. The world's largest QR code was somebody's just random project.
Now, QR code is those funny-looking things that are on products that you can put your smartphone up to and snap a picture, and the smartphone, if it's smart enough, has the right software in it, will tell you about that product.
Right.
And you designed the world's largest
QR code. The world's largest.
How large?
It was over 100,000 square feet, if I recall correctly. I would need to check.
You'd have to get into an airplane to take a picture of it on your smartphone.
Absolutely, or you could look at the fine GIS data that the city provides.
So what was the point of that?
The point of that was it was fun.
Okay.
I mean, if you're looking at other things we've done, we've supported local teachers. For example, there's a small computer called a Raspberry Pi, which is a $35 computer, which is designed so that if a student breaks it, it's not a financial end of the world. So they're now encouraged to experiment with it, both on a software and electronics basis, because if they blow it up, you know, the world won't come to a screaming end. And so we provided support for the teachers in some of the local schools in order to actually do that.
Well, I've noticed that one of the great fears among older people and people who have – mostly older people, because young kids who have never touched a computer before just take to it like it's – like a baby takes to their bottle. It's just – it's innate in them. But older people are afraid that they're going to break it. Can you? Break it just by using it? I mean, if you don't throw it on the floor, can you break it?
Not really. not really. I mean, anything that can be broken can be fixed. And
But can you break it? What could you possibly do to it in the process of just interfacing with it that would cause it damage? I suppose you could erase the hard drive.
Yeah, there is nothing a normal user could do that would really break it. I mean, there's research into this, and there's some heavy stuff that can be done, but nothing a normal user is going to do.
Now, I know that by day you work in the computer security field for a major company.
Yes.
Which will go unnamed, but nonetheless, that's what you do. So you also work by night with people who call themselves hackers at this hackerspace. And these are proficient people who are trying to become more proficient and who are very creative and are trying to encourage other people to use their skills in more and more different ways. Do you ever worry that you are facilitating the next person who's going to write some malicious code and do some serious damage?
I don't worry about that at all, because if somebody comes in and I just really am uncomfortable, then I just won't teach them. It's one advantage that we have as a private organization, and we're unstructured. Mm-hmm. So, if I get, an uneasy feeling about somebody, then I just simply will change the subject and just not teach them those kinds of skills.
Let me share some emails that have come in while we've been talking. Jane in Concord writes, I heard recently of someone whose business accounts were held hostage, encrypted, and a ransom was required in order to regain access. The virus, was apparently contained in the summary sidebar section of email using Outlook as the search engine. Can you please talk about the frequency of this sort of thing and how to prevent it?
So it sounds to me what they're describing is a piece of malware called CryptoLocker. And what it does is when the machine is infected, it looks for all kinds of mostly Office applications and PDFs, encrypts them, and then holds them ransom. I think it's $300 US. Off the top of my head.
Can it be eradicated by a piece of software?
It cannot. Well, you can eradicate it, but you can't get your data back because the data is encrypted. The data is gone unless you pay the ransom.
And what do you do to acquire this delight?
That particular delight was spread by email. People would receive an email, usually something like, you know, your UPS package has been delayed. Mm-hmm. Click here to fill in a form, and then they will double click. They'll open up something like a PDF, and then that PDF contains malware, which mm-hmm. would then execute.
And how do you protect yourself from that?
It's part of the literacy piece. It's knowing what to click and not to click, and know how to validate a source.
But if you have valid antivirus software or malware. Detection on your computer, would that catch this?
These things are, you know, these viruses are evolving so quickly that if you're not running regular, you know, virus protection software updates, or, you know, again, this is the hacking, the dark side of hacking. These things evolve quicker than the software evolves.
And this is part of computer literacy, because if it's one thing to buy the most up-to-date modern computer that you can afford. It's another thing that you must keep it. You must download the software updates and the virus updates. You must. And people don't think about it. They open the box, they turn it on, it works, and then they never think about it again.
Right.
You've got to do this, right?
And users need to be thoughtful about what they're doing. One of the things that we do with the county is we have all of our systems are thoroughly protected, updated regularly. What is hard to control and hard to manage is someone clicking on an email or something that they just really shouldn't.
Well, what does that mean? They really shouldn't. How would you know you shouldn't?
Well, again, we're talking about literacy. It's like you would know anything. You would have to have someone that would give you the opportunity to learn the pros and cons and the weaknesses of your behavior.
And even then, it's no guarantee.
Is there a good rule of thumb that you can use? If you want to be computer literate, and I got one yesterday in my email at home that I did not click on because it said something. There was an urgent message in the line in the opening, and I thought, I don't know who this person is.
Delete key.
So that's a good. If you don't know who the person that sent it to you is, and it says something like "Open this now" or "You need to update this," don't do it.
Right.
If it's that important, it'll come to you again.
Yeah.
But will it come to you? I mean, will it come in the form of an email? That's the question. I mean, seriously, if you have software that needs to be updated, they're not going to email you. They're going to just do it.
Mm-hmm. The second most common method of actual infection is things like file sharing networks and that kind of stuff as well. So avoid those as well. But for emails, you have to just know. Unfortunately, it's something unfortunately that comes with experience.
You just said file sharing networks. Avoid those. And this guy over here, Dr. Eric Friedman, is trying to teach people in communities how to build these networks. Okay. We're at loggerheads here.
Well, no. I mean, I think you're referencing things like torrent, clients
BitTorrent.
Like BitTorrent. That's a completely different ballgame. But we are trying to teach people about the value of, or neighborhoods especially, about the value of public versus private networks. So what does it mean to build a private portal where people can share information about what's happening in their neighborhood, to build a better sense of community and to take action around certain localized events? Versus what does it mean to operate in Facebook like a public platform, either with an open group or a closed group, because they're confronted with this dilemma. They want to talk about what their neighborhood is doing and shine a spotlight on it, but there are also more sort of intimate, private, personal security questions, dialogues that they want to have that are not public. So it's teaching people what are the appropriate and perhaps different tools that will help you accomplish either a public or a private conversation.
Bruce emails, I applaud what Dr. Friedman and others are doing with Digital Charlotte. Mike, to your point about the ever-changing nature of technology, it seems to me that Digital Charlotte is trying to do the equivalent of teaching people to write versus teaching people how to use a typewriter. That is, they are emphasizing digital literacy skills that people can apply to any number of platforms and technologies, whether they currently exist or are on the horizon. That's what you're really talking about. You're talking about how to analyze the data you're getting to see whether it's legitimate, what the source of it is, whether you can trust it.
Correct. And then also knowing how to sort of produce your own media as well. Mm-hmm. So not just to be a good sort of critical consumer, but also to be a good critical ethical producer, because a lot of these viruses, for example, emerge because we go to a website and we willfully subscribe to, I subscribe, I check here, I want your newsletter. So people have to be aware when they're surfing the web that they're also, cookies are collecting and they're then also being susceptible.
And I know that the Knight School at Queens has chosen to use the definition of digital and media literacy posed by Renee Hobbs in a book called Digital and Media Literacy, A Plan of Action, to make responsible choices and access information by locating and sharing materials and comprehending information and ideas, to analyze messages by identifying the author, purpose, and point of view, and evaluating the quality and credibility of the content. Is that really any different than it was in the analog world where everything was on paper?
I think it's fairly similar, but people have to be much more aware of the speed, the sort of the rapid nature of the communication, mm-hmm. and the difficulty is to rescind. So people access to information is so much quicker that people are making judgments at lightning speed, so they don't necessarily take the time to reflect. And they're also presented with, again, a rapidly emerging media economy where they're always presented with new right. types of information, new platforms that they're simply not familiar with. So it's this familiarity.
You're working, Brian, with Queen's University on these projects, and you also have this GIS day going on in the lobby here at Spirit Square. Who should come to that?
Well, this particular activity targets a lot of people in the education. There's going to be school kids coming through today, so it's an informative educational program. But as far as the GIS tools, not only GIS Day, but GIS tools that we have, anyone might find them interesting or helpful. We have some that we know businesses use fairly regularly. It's hard for me to draw a specific target segment.
And aside from GIS tools on the internet from the county, what other digital information is there for people to use?
I would sort of put it in three buckets. There are things that are really just records and archives. Mm-hmm. It's just content. There's a lot of reports or websites that are report-driven, and then there's the data that's, the raw material.
Brian Cox is Director of Business Support Services in Mecklenburg County. Dr. Eric Friedman, Dean of the Knight School of Communications at Queen's University of Charlotte. How can they get to you about Digital Charlotte quickly?
DigitalCharlotte.org.
Okay, and Red Davies, founder of Hackerspace Charlotte. How can they get to you?
HackerspaceCharlotte.org.
Okay. Thank you all for being here. We just scratched the surface of this, but surf the web and use your computer safely.